We've all heard that there is less ice in the Arctic than in the past, but less is still a lot when you're new to it. Lisa Hatlin served as executive officer of the Maple during the voyage. It was smooth sailing until the ship was about 100 miles east of Utqiagvik, formerly known as Barrow.
It was only about 3/10 ice, but again, never seen ice and navigating it. We're like, oh my God, this is it. And the visibility dropped to like less than 100 yards, of course. And I was actually on watch conning through that, and we were just dodging. It was a blast, but we were staying behind Laurier and Frosty. We let Frosty go in between us. They weren't really breaking an ice path. It was more of just picking the best route.
The Sir Wilfrid Laurier and the research ship Frosty were the first of four Canadian ships to escort the Maple on its voyage. A veteran ice pilot from the Canadian Coast Guard also served on board with the Maple's bridge crew. And it turns out the Northern Patrol in Canada is a little more mellow than its U.S. counterpart, as Hatlin discovered on a visit to the Laurier.
So they're allowed to drink underway. They can have their beers. And so we're like, no, we can't drink. But they opened their cantinas, and we got all sorts of Canadian swag. So we all got our Laurier t-shirts and hats and everything. That's it. Ball caps. Swapping ball caps out there is everything.
The Maple took on more than swag. After parting ways with the Laurier, the ship met the Canadian Coast Guard ship Amundsen in Queen Maud Gulf and loaded 11,000 gallons of fuel. The Amundsen, primarily a research vessel with 80 scientists on board, came down the channel that the Maple was heading up. After an exchange of information between the two vessels, the Maple turned north to rendezvous with its true icebreaking escort, the Canadian Coast Guard ship Terry Fox. Hatlin says this is where things got serious.
8,000 miles of a transit came down to these 2 days in the ice. Terry Fox would break ice in front of us. The problem was that this ice would just fill right back in the path that they broke for us. And so we had to transit at a particularly higher rate. It was about 6 knots, which you don't think is very fast. But when you're only 200 yards behind the guy, it gets a little nerve-wracking.
Hatlin says the Maple used radar ranges to keep its distance from the Terry Fox, which was equipped with a type of brake light to alert following ships that it had stopped. And it did stop, Hatlin says, 2 or 3 times.
We didn't even have to back down. All we would have to do is just bring the throttle stop, and the friction of the ice would literally just stop us within a couple hundred yards.
With a single screw and rudder, the Maple was also less maneuverable than her twin-screw escort, and Hatlin says it was difficult to make the tight turns around larger pieces of ice. The Maple's hull is ice-strengthened, but the constant scraping required engineers to inspect the bilges for flooding around the clock. Those factors, combined with unreliable electronic navigation in some parts of the passage, made for the most stressful 2 days of the voyage. And if those 230 miles of icebreaker channel in Victoria Strait are stressful for the Coast Guard, what does that mean for the commercialization of the Northwest Passage?
So the Arctic is not open yet, and any ship going up there needs to be aware of the environmental conditions, the hazards, and don't go up there blindly, otherwise they will become a SAR case.
SAR being the Coast Guard term for search and rescue. The Maple was home free by the time it reached St. John's, Newfoundland, where the crew spent 3 days ashore after 31 days without touching land. From there, it was a quick run down the eastern seaboard to Baltimore. The crew has since come home, but in April, they'll return to Baltimore to pick up the 225-foot Kukui, a near copy of the Maple, which will have been refurbished and ready for a voyage, this time through the Panama Canal, to its new home port in Sitka. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.